You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the latest episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Edward Song, and I am an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. And as always, well, not necessarily always, I suppose, but almost always, I'm joined by Coyle Neal, who is an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. How are you, Professor Neal, today?
I'm doing all right. How are you, Professor Song?
Professor Song is tired, but I am keeping my head above water.
It is late on a Friday, so it is reasonable for you to be tired.
Yeah, I also went on a long run, and so...
That is less reasonable a thing to do.
I tell my students that running marathons is like the new thing to do in middle age, which I totally think is true, and it's much, much better for you than going out and buying a fancy sports car or having affairs. And... So I try to encourage them to start running now, so by the time they get up to be my age, they'll be really, really fast in Boston Marathon qualifiers and all of that. But anyways.
That is an interesting life goal to give your students.
Are you, well, you're younger than me anyway. Are you even 40 yet?
I am not 40 yet.
Oh, you are just a child. You're not even a man. You're not even 40.
I'm also not a runner, so there's that.
Well... Funny things happen when you hit middle age. The crazy thing about hitting middle age is that, of course, all the things that people say about hitting middle age are true. And you know that they're true, but it's different than sort of knowing that something is true and sort of feeling that something is true.
Right, right. It's the, what is the Edwards line about the difference between knowing honey is sweet and, you know, having honey on your toast. Like, they're two, one of those is just intellectual and the other of those is experiential.
So, sorry, which Edwards is that? Are we talking about Jonathan Edwards?
Yeah, Jonathan Edwards. Not John Edwards, the psychic, the musician, or the politician.
There's a John Edwards who's a psychic and a John Edwards who's a musician.
And a John Edwards who's a politician.
Well, the latter I am familiar with his oeuvre, but right. the former two I am unfamiliar with there.
I only know that they exist. I have never listened to the music or know nothing
about
them.
Hey, you know what we should do? We should try to get them both on at the same time and interview them for an episode.
Well, the John Edwards, who's a psychic, I think, and if I'm wrong, this will just show you how little I know about this world, but I think he's the guy who does, like, the crossing over TV show where, like, brings people on and tries to get in touch with dead family members.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, look, if he's any good, he knows that we're talking about him now, and he'll email us.
My phone will start ringing any minute.
Okay, let's just wait. You ready?
All right.
Here we go. No. You have to do this. You have to think your phone number, because if you don't think your phone number, he won't know what your phone number is.
What is my phone number? I never call my own office phone.
Okay, I just thought my phone number. So any second now, John Edwards should be...
Well, you have to think your phone number and his name.
Okay, here we go. Ready?
Right.
I'm doing it right now. There we go.
This is like applied theology here.
This is amazing.
Well anyways. My phone is not ringing, so.
I don't know that we have time to do this. But honestly, booking them, that would be amazing. Both of them at the same time. And I bet that would be really captivating radio.
It would be something. That's
Kristen
for sure.
Filippic, if you are listening, get on that now.
We want to do a profiles episode. I know nothing about these people, but...
let me remind our listeners that against all odds, our show continues apace. We are nearing our one-year anniversary. I suppose I should know that off the top of my head. It's sometime in April, and Coyle and I would like to celebrate our one-year anniversary by having a kind of an Ask Me Anything episode. So we hereby officially solicit our listeners, our friends, our enemies... Please send us your questions, specific questions for both Coyle and me, questions for either Coyle and me, general thoughts that you've had and wondered about what we thought about things, questions, comments, ridicule, criticisms about things that we have said. Shoot us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com, or equally go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. Leave us your questions there. We will tackle those questions in about a month. In any
and,
case,
if we do get 25 independent comments, questions, and so on, Ed Song will fight a bear. We're just going to throw that out there.
You made that joke last week, but I ended up cutting it.
Yeah, you cut it because of the seriousness of the content. That excuse doesn't apply.
I suppose that's true. If we get more than 25, I will, in fact, wrestle a bear. And we will Facebook Live that. But if we get less than 25, Coyle is going to strip to his britches, oil up, and wrestle an angry raccoon.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we will get more than 25 just so people don't have to see that. So well done, Ed. Way to get our ratings up.
Well, yeah, anyways. Okay. Well, so there, regardless, please send us your questions. That'll be awesome, and we look forward to that. With that said, we are obviously talking about a subject that is a little bit less morally fraught than our topic last week, though, well, related in some ways, right? And,
sure.
And certainly very important. We're talking about constitutional interpretation. One of the primary areas of intense political focus, who's on the Supreme Court, what decisions are coming up, attracts tons of attention with regard to the important issues that they discuss. Do you know what the timetable is on the upcoming Supreme Court hearings?
You mean hearings in the Senate, right? Not the court's case schedule.
Yeah, no. Yeah, the hearings for Gorsuch?
I don't actually know what they have scheduled. Again, I would imagine it's going to be sooner rather than later, though. They've been pretty prompt with most of Trump's appointments, so I would assume that's going to be true of his, you know, sort of biggest appointment so far.
So in any case, those issues are always in the air, and they're particularly in the air these days, so we wanted to roll out and do an episode just talking about constitutional interpretation specifically.
Right.
So Cole, you want to kick us off in our tour of the issue?
Yeah, so sort of three big categories when we're talking constitutional interpretation in the modern world. There are some different categories in the 19th century, but very, very few people hold to those anymore. The big two, I guess, the two that will be dominating everything we hear in the media over the next few weeks as we get closer to the Senate hearing on Trump's appointment. Are originalism and non-originalism. Ed, do you have a better name for non-originalism? Living constitution, sometimes you'll hear people talk about, but there's not sort of a good catch-all for the other side.
Yeah, as we will see momentarily, I wouldn't describe my view as being living constitutionalism, and
right.
I kind of hate that moniker.
Which is the response of many non-originalists, so... It gets used occasionally, but by and large, the people who are on that side don't like it.
Yeah, but I think that's the official language: living constitutionalism.
Right. Yeah, it may very well be. Even though there are lots of people who don't like it. So the sort of one sentence summary of the difference between the two is originalism thinks that what matters most is the intent of the people who wrote the Constitution, both the text of it and the various amendments. The non-originalists think that what matters are the values that we hold today, the things that matter to us. So if you sort of think through how do you read the text, what sorts of values do you see in the Constitution, what sorts of supplementary materials do you use, and so on, the originalist is going to read the text as it was understood, or try to read it as it was understood by the reasonable reader of the 1780s.
Yeah.
Or again, with the later amendments, you would read according to the time frame in which they were written. In terms of what values and what structure they see there, they're going to, again, look at those original values, things like federalism and checks and balances and separation of powers and so on. If you must use cultural or supplementary materials to interpret for the places where the Constitution is vague or unclear, then they're going to say you need to read the Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers, Madison's notes on the ratification process, letters between the founders, and so on.
Yeah. I was just going to jump in there. On your first formulation, you said original intent.
Yes.
But not all originalists are going to be focus on intent. I mean, Scalia is like this. Scalia doesn't... He's interested in the commonly accepted public meanings of the words.
Well, what do you mean by original public meaning? I guess maybe we're just saying the same thing.
So maybe that's right. So you look at cruel and unusual punishment. What did those words mean at the time in which that text was written? So would it rule out? But that's different from asking, well, what did the signatories of the Constitution mean? What did they intend to mean?
Oh, okay, yeah. So in that sense, yes, originalists, whether they're going for the intent of the guys who signed it, or what sort of everyone in the 1780s would have understood,
yeah,
that's the originalist side. The non-originalist is the person who says, no, what does it mean now?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. So, yeah, and so, again, I would say originalism is about the legal concepts that we are divining are fixed. They are from the past. And then there are some people who say they're fixed in the intentions of the authors of the document, or they're not fixed by that, but they're fixed by the original public meaning of the words, right? So it might be the case that, the original public meaning of cruel and unusual punishment wouldn't have counted public hangings as being cruel and unusual. But then it's quite possible that we might have good reasons for thinking that all of the founders, in fact, intended that, right? Let's say we look at their diaries and they sort of write about how public hangings are such a cruel and unusual form of punishment.
Right.
Right, so that's an instance in which... So those are dueling originalist interpretations. And on one, it would sort of count public hangings as in, and on the other, it would hang them as out. And then just one reason to be skeptical about that whole divining the intentions strategy is like, well, whose intentions, right?
Lots of founders, right?
Yeah, clearly, exactly. Is there such thing as like a public intention? That's a kind of a crazy concept. But
yeah, and again, I guess the reason I'm pushing back a little bit against this idea of the fixed versus the not fixed is that there are certainly non-originalists who have fixed ideas, right? Again, the difference is where do those fixed ideas come from? So with public hanging as being cruel and unusual punishment, whichever stripe of originalist you are, it would be very difficult to argue that, according to the strict text, public hanging is somehow unconstitutional. Whereas if you're a non-originalist, you could say something to the effect of, but that makes us feel really bad today, therefore it's unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. So, but the fixity is fixed in the past. That's the important
point. And again, it's yeah, so that is the primary difference, is who gets to sort of define how the Constitution is interpreted, the present or the past.
Yeah, so for originalists, constitutional interpretation is fundamentally about divining something from the past.
Right.
And for living constitutionalists, it's not an exercise in intellectual archaeology.
Right. It's an exercise in something else, right? Self-analysis or reading the polls or...
Moral theory. Or
moral reflection, right. They're not the only games in town, so we should come back to originalism, non-originalism. They're the big ones, but just to briefly off-road on the postmodern theories, which I will out myself as thinking that most of these are reprehensible, but utterly fascinating for all that. I mean, it's like studying Machiavelli or Rousseau. It's always more fun to study evil than to study good. Well, I think there's something similar here. So if originalism and non-originalism are kind of the two dominant terms, two dominant schools, in the 1970s, there's a reaction against these. Some scholars basically decide they're fed up with the infighting between liberals and conservatives, especially since that fighting meant that basically nothing got done. And this is sort of both on the right and on the left. You have shouting academic, especially academically, that gets kind of louder and triller as each side battles for dominance. Until finally, a group of scholars breaks away, interestingly, largely influenced by biblical hermeneutics and literary criticism. So this is sort of other fields breaking into constitutional theory, which makes sense. I mean, those are both disciplines that are dedicated to the interpretation and explanation of difficult and obscure texts. Nathan Gilmore will love the name I'm about to mention. Stanley Fish is really the guy that kicks this off. His book, Doing What Comes Naturally, is foundational in postmodern constitutional theory. So what these guys say is that...
I have to say, people who get that book because they're interested in the title are going to be very disappointed by the contents.
Yeah, I think they will be disappointed for a number of reasons, but especially that.
Yes.
So what these guys say is that that no matter what, we're never really going to be consistent or coherent when it comes to interpreting the Constitution. So no one's a conservative, consistent conservative. No one's a consistent liberal, which means that to some extent judges are always being dishonest when they're interpreting the Constitution. And when we add to that the fact that their fighting has led to sort of a social, legal, political stalemate that doesn't go anywhere, it's not like we're even getting the rewards of our dishonesty anymore because no one's winning, so no one's getting the policy they like. So clearly there's something wrong with the legal system itself. The American system of justice, the American legal system is inherently flawed, and we need to be critical of it, and we need to study new ways to pursue justice. So this comes to be called critical legal studies. So these guys look at either the pursuit of original intent or the pursuit of neutral modern values on the non-originalist side and say that they're both wrong. They argue that all you really have in both of those cases is a judge reading his own wishes into the law under illogical and morally incoherent systems. Mm-hmm. So they look at a conservative who says, you know, the founders wanted every American to have a gun and be a member of a militia. And here's a quote from Madison proving it. And they point out that conservative judge probably believed that before he found the quote. Or the liberal judge who says the Constitution means that every American has the right to universal health care. Well, he probably believed that before he ever read the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So really, both the conservative and the liberal are just pursuing power, and the structure of our court system allows them to continue doing so, and justice gets lost in the process. So they even go a step farther, and they say that justice is actually impossible in our current legal system, because even when it gets things right, justice is not accomplished, because when they happen to, you know, sort of accidentally do what should be done, you know, the murderer, or the person who's accused of murder, who actually committed murder, is punished for murder, injustice is still done there, because all it does is reinforce our belief in a false system, right? It's confirming this idea that somehow the system is okay.
Mm. Can I ask you a question? Can you think of cases that you think were decisions that were made that politically you were happy with, but you thought that on pure constitutional interpretation grounds, you thought they were decided incorrectly?
Honestly, I would say the decision not to hold a Senate hearing on Merrick Garland, which is not a Supreme Court case.
Well, yeah, that's not a Supreme Court. Yeah.
But I would say that is a case where, I mean, the results, Garland would have been an okay, like he would have been a fine Supreme Court justice. And maybe in the strictest technical sense, there's no reason the Senate can't set its own schedule and decide what they're going to do. But that's not what they said they were doing. They said explicitly, this is a political decision, and we are going to treat this Supreme Court office as a pawn in a game between the Republicans and Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that's completely inappropriate. That's neither the intent nor the structure of what's supposed to happen when something is going on with the Supreme Court and with the Supreme Court nomination.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that.
Even if I'm okay with the result.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a certain way in which they're well within their constitutional privilege. I mean, the Constitution certainly doesn't say anything about what time frame these things need to happen, but it certainly violates all the sorts of norms of...
Right.
But in any case... But can you think of... So that's fine. Like, in some ways, the tricky thing for... And in a funny kind of way, this is just a problem for... Maybe I shouldn't say just a problem, but it's kind of uniquely a problem for originalists. Right, because the originalist strategy is, well, there's always the analogy of the baseball umpire, right? I'm just calling balls and strikes. I'm just applying the rules. I don't care. I'm not rooting for either team. I mean, living constitutional interpreters also understand their business to be sort of playing the special kind of procedural role that justices play in our kind of system of government. But there's a way in which, because that theory of constitutional interpretation is a little bit more flexible and a little bit more tied to getting the political values right, as opposed to, this has nothing to do with political values. So there's a way in which, because of the structural features of the originalist approach to interpretation, there should be no substantive political factors weighing into their decisions. They're just looking at the text. What does the text say? How does it apply? And so if that's the case, like, you would expect there to be not infrequent instances in which their interpretation of what the law says comes apart from their substantive political values. So, for example, I mean, Scalia will occasionally disappoint conservatives. I mean, you'll know this much better than I do, since you actually study this stuff. But I'm trying to think, like, he's kind of police-friendly, but at the same time, there are certainly certain rulings when he side with prisoners.
Right, so he is one of his major contributions is sort of bringing back, you know, and I don't know the criminal law side of this as well as I should, but kind of Fourth through Eighth Amendment interpretations, right?
Bringing those back.
And he could be a little wishy-washy on the First Amendment. I mean, religious freedom was not a place where he was sort of consistently on my side. And I my impression, and I'm not a Scalia scholar, but my impression was usually that it was because he read the First Amendment in a way a little bit different than I read it. But because he was reading it that way, he felt constrained to occasionally side with the other side of the court, mm-hmm. the non-originalist mm-hmm. on the court, because he thought that was a more accurate reading of the text.
Mm-hmm. So one reason why I kind of like Scalia more than I like, say, Thomas, is that I sort of feel like he's more principled in that way. And in Thomas's case, I just think it's really hard to find instances in which he votes against what he wishes the substantive outcome is going to be.
Right.
But in Scalia's case, I don't know how much you wanted to sort of talk individual cases going on, but Bush v. Gore in 2000, for a lot of progressives, lots of people sort of see that as being like an abomination of originalist interpretation, right? So the originalist interpretation thing is like, all this voting stuff, that's for states, man. So whatever the state wants to do.
Well, yeah, you have this weird switch, right? It's on both sides, right? It's where you have the all of a sudden the non-originalists are saying, oh, no, we shouldn't be deciding this. This is a state issue. And the originalists are saying, oh, hey, this is something the Supreme Court needs to be involved in. I mean, that is one of the cases where there's this total flip. And no one really has their hands clean in terms of their own interpretation. And it's entirely along partisan lines.
So, yeah,
Bush v. Gore is it.
Though I would say, I mean, it's a ridiculous decision, and they even went so far as to say, and this decision really applies only to this case, and people shouldn't come back and use this for any guidance with regard to deciding future cases, which you can't say, right? Like, that's not how the common law works.
Well, O'Connor says that all the time. I mean, that's I don't think she wrote the opinion in Bush v. Gore. I don't remember off the top of my head, but that is sort of classic Sandra Day O'Connor, like, this decision in this particular case only applies right here and nowhere beyond it. And she often obviously tried to write her opinions in such a way that you couldn't take them and run different directions with them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're right. It's not the way it's supposed to work, and it's not the way it really does work in practice. But that was often at least one of her goals. And in Bush v. Gore, again, whoever wrote that opinion, I don't remember now, that was also the case.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I fear that I've sort of pulled us a little bit off track.
Maybe no, it's okay. Let me just finish these critical legal folks, and then we can get back to the originalist, non-originalist. So critical legal studies sort of has two children. One of them is feminist constitutional theory that takes lots of the CLS arguments and reworks them into the feminist image. So they argue that we could never have true justice in America because the system was designed and built and is currently maintained by men. We claim to believe in representation and democracy, yet we keep using a system that was built only by white guys. So again, the CLS claim that the system is broken is combined with the feminist spin. It's broken because it's designed by people who are not us. They're white aristocratic men. How can we expect women to get justice in a system that they had no say in creating, that only recently they've even had true access to, and that continues to exist without their consent? And again, I think there are some legitimate arguments here. There are some things that are sort of worth hammering out. It runs into sort of the same problems that CLS runs into. You know, what's your alternative? How do you want to fix this? And I'm not a feminist scholar, so the Christian Feminist Podcast folks can speak more to this. But from what I understand, the result of that question, so the result of, all right, what do you want to have happen, sort of reveals a major divide in modern feminism, where you have sort of this conflict over the nature of the goals of the movement. You know, do feminists ultimately want to be treated equally the same way as men, with everyone being treated sort of the same, or do they want to be treated like women? Do they want to be treated according to the things that they value and cherish because they're women, or should there just be sort of one way that we treat everyone of all genders? And the person in terms of the Supreme Court who really revealed this division was Sandra Day O'Connor. The big question surrounding her, according to feminist scholars, was, you know, is there some kind of neutral category out there of good judge that applies to men and women alike, and you can just sort of plug someone of any gender into it, and does she have a good chance of fitting into that? Or is there something about good judges that is inherently masculine that she will have to set aside part of her femininity in order to reach? And should we, if that is the case, do we need to have a different kind of office of judge that's more suitable for women? And that is not a question I can answer. That's just sort of the result of the discussion. Last, sort of the second child of the critical legal studies folk are the critical race theory. These scholars look at CLS and say, you know, you've got something here, you just don't have quite enough. The system is flawed and unjust because it's not representative of us. It was created and established and is maintained by white dominance. This movement comes at the end of the civil rights movement in the later 70s and starts to take off. And in the wake of the Supreme Court moving away from racial issues and onto economics and poverty issues, you know, you have this great sort of Brown versus Board of Education moment, and then several cases after that where the court is heavily involved in pursuing racial justice. After that time period, they start focusing on poverty and economics, which starts to raise questions amongst scholars of what is sort of the true role of the courts in racial relations anyway. And if we're not going to get justice through the system, maybe the system is broken. Maybe we need a new way to do justice. So one of the problems, according to these scholars, is that we're so affected and infected by racism that we don't even see it in ourselves or in the system. So they'll look at something like intent, right, which we talked about a little bit at the beginning of the episode. You know, is this policy or procedure created with the goal of harming minorities or not? That's a question a court might ask. So, you know, if I hang a racial slur on the front of my business, I'm guilty. If I have a hiring policy that requires a certain level of education that just happens to exclude whatever the minority in my community is, well, I'm not guilty because I'm not intentionally excluding anyone based on race, right? So it's sort of two examples that the court might look at and make a decision one way or another. The problem, according to the critical racial studies guys, is that intent aside, we are still shaped by a culture and a history that sets certain patterns into our unconscious and makes us act in ways that are racist, whether we intend to or not. And they'll even say, look, most people don't intend to be racist, and yet that's still the culture we live in. Mm-hmm. And we could talk about this in any part of American life, but in terms of the law, this becomes a serious question of justice. Our courts have the noble goal of using the law to destroy formal racism, but that's really only touching the surface, right? Segregation policies formally passed by legislatures and endorsed by communities have been overturned, but that does nothing to the underlying culture. That cultural undercurrent of racism hasn't really been affected, and it can't be touched by the laws, because laws ultimately are built on top of the culture. So As with the CLS and as with the feminists, we have the question, you know, okay, what's your alternative? The system's broken, so what are you going to do about it? And this time, the critical race crowd is much better at giving an answer to this question. Mm-hmm. So when they say we need an entirely different way to do law, what the critical race people mean is that they need something appropriate to the culture in question. Narrative is sort of the most common point of appeal here, and this is often coming out of the African American culture. And this none of this is coming from me. These are from these scholars, and I'll try to find some links to essays that I can put up. So they'll talk about, you know, someone who grew up in the inner city, and all they've ever really been exposed to is a particular culture, a particular lifestyle, maybe a culture that says includes messages over and over to something to the effect of, this guy disrespected me, so I shot him and protected my honor. Well, when that's the narrative you grow up with, is it really fair, is it really just to take someone from that background and charge them with murder when they kill someone? We need a court system that reflects the culture of the person it's claiming to judge. According to the narrative of that culture, is he guilty or has he done the right and honorable thing? Now, according to the current American legal system is, he's guilty, right? He's committed murder. You need to take the punishment for that. The critical racial theory response is that the American legal system was built by white people on top of a white culture. It doesn't legitimately reflect these other cultures within it, and that's sort of a vibrant and ongoing argument within the discipline. So really central to all of these critical legal studies, feminism and critical racial studies, is the idea that law is built on culture. That ultimately leads to, I think, an undermining of law as it currently exists by treating it as a political creation of the socioeconomic context. If I can maybe say that slightly differently, these guys are saying the law is nothing more than power imposed by the dominant culture, and we need to make sure that it's either our culture that's doing the dominating, or that the law is broken and something more fair is set up in its place. I think that's all I've got on those subjects. Sorry, I've gone on for a while here. I'm sorry about that.
No, that's great. That's all great. Shall we go back and sort of talk a little bit more about arguments in favor of originalism or living constitutionalism?
Yeah, that's fine.
You know, so one thing that I was just going to say about these theories of interpretation is that you often hear people in contemporary discourse sort of just announcing the importance of hewing to the text, or alternately, I mean, I don't know, what are the slogans that living constitutionalists throw around? Well, whatever those slogans are, but which sort of totally avoid, like, the underlying justifications for these views, right? Because it's not like the Constitution tells you how to interpret it, right? It wasn't as if it would be awesome if it was accompanied by a theory of interpretation. I mean, the whole idea of judicial review was more or less invented. So it's not like you can look to the Constitution for a theory of interpretation. It's not like you can just keep on repeating the importance of the vibrancy of the living Constitution or the importance of hewing to the text as an argument in favor of one of these views. We need arguments for these views. Do you want to say something about originalism, and then I can say something about living constitutionalism?
I mean, So I don't know that I have anything specific to say about it. I would want to point out that it's not necessarily a strict liberal conservative breakdown,
mm-hmm.
right? So you can be a liberal and an originalist,
sure.
and a conservative and a non-originalist. It's not common,
yeah.
But you can be that. So it is probably important not to associate these, certainly not with any political party, but also not necessarily with kind of theoretical ideological movements.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's much more about what do you value most when you're interpreting and applying the Constitution, the past, the intent, or the public meaning, whichever route you want to take, when it was written, or the contemporary values, right? What we think is important now. One of my biggest concerns with the living Constitution attitude is, and this is pretty much pure Scalia, in part, what is important now is always changing. So if you're a living Constitution type, you're basically going to have reinterpretation of the law every time there's a new Supreme Court justice added. You're going to get a a completely different way of doing things. And ultimately, that undermines the value of the law. Like, one of the things that makes law work is that it is mostly unchanging, and that if it changes, it changes through legitimate legislative processes, which is the other side of it. Yeah. Is we have a way of changing things in society. We have a way of, yeah. of affecting what the law says. We have a way of affecting what the Constitution says. And that way is not Supreme Court interpretation. It's explicitly and intentionally not Supreme Court interpretation. It is legislative action or the amendment process. So
yeah.
I think, and in this case, I think the originalists are sort of absolutely right. If we want something to change, the way to do it is to go to the legislature. And if that's too hard, well, that's too bad. Then the change doesn't need to happen.
Yeah, right. And so, I mean, I was just going to say that, to me, the most compelling arguments about originalism appeal to structural values of stability and order and things like that, right? And so we have the political sphere in which people make substantive political decisions about what they think is best. They enact laws, but there just needs to be an underlying stability for a society. So this is an extra constitutional value. Again, the Constitution doesn't tell you how to interpret it, but the extra constitutional value of predictability, stability of the law, right? Justices play this specific kind of a role of just interpreting what the law, whether we're talking about the Constitution or statutory legal acts, they're not there to make the law. If they were there to make the law, then that just introduces a kind of an instability into the system that's detrimental to the overall health and flourishing of a society. And you can also sort of appeal to democratic values, as you say. You know, if people don't like a law, then they can vote to change the law. And when justices make rulings that conflict with law, you know, conflict with laws that are passed, there's a way in which there's this imposition from on high against the will of the people. So to me, like, the best arguments in favor of originalism are like those appealing to the extrajudicial value of stability and order and predictability and democratic governance. And then I'll just say, on the living Constitution side, you know, so I wouldn't describe my view as being living constitutionalist. Maybe I'll sort of say, maybe we can both sort of say what our views, I mean, I guess it's pretty clear what your view is. But
well, with some modifications.
Yeah. So we can get to that in a second. But I'll just say, like, from the perspective of, so what's the living constitutionalist? Well, it's the idea, so first of all, most importantly, that the meaning of the text, whether we're talking about the Constitution or legal statutes, isn't fixed in time. Its central meaning isn't fixed at the time in which it was issued, but it is subject to interpretation. And the big criticism of living constitutionalism, you can see it arising precisely out of those originalist values of predictability and stability, is that it just sort of, it opens up this kind of Pandora's box of constantly changing and reevaluating the law. It just introduces a kind of an unpredictability. You can't predict it, which is bad. And I'm kind of sympathetic. And it's just a kind of a wishy-washy theory of interpretation. It doesn't really tell you how to sit down and do law. But one of the things that kind of animates it and motivates it is just this idea. I mean, if you think about a law, it's passed at some point in time. And you might think that there's something unfair about how one generation can legitimately bind the moral choices of another. So it sort of arises, one argument in favor of living constitutionalism is just this idea about it's an attempt to answer a kind of an intergenerational problem. Certain people in the past, they pass a particular law, they die, they go away. Here we are, a new generation of people. That law is coercively enforced against us. how is it that the choices of one generation come to bind the choices of another? So one argument in favor of living constitutionalism sort of has to do with, like, the it's an argument about legitimacy or justification.
Right, and the originalist response to that is always going to be, look, it in part, yes, you should have a society that is bound by the past. You have that great Burke line about the democracy of the or I guess it's the Chesterton line about the democracy of the dead. And the Burke line about a social contract between the past, the present, and the future.
Yeah, yeah.
But more than that, the originalist is going to say, look, you're not bound by that. You can change the law.
Yeah.
Like, so go change the law. If you don't like it, the law was put in place. The law can be undone.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the problem is, how is it being done? So it comes back to a question of process, right? Is it legitimate for the Supreme Court to take this into its own hands and impose such a change on the nation when there is a process established for it?
Yeah. And, you know, and then I would say the other thing that kind of animates living constitutionalism is just going to be objections about originalism, that it just gets things wrong. So, you know, so I mentioned that example of cruel and unusual punishment. So, I mean, it's pretty clear, don't you think, that in the 18th century, public hanging was a perfectly legitimate form of capital punishment and wouldn't have been counted as cruel and unusual.
Right. Or putting someone in the stocks, right?
Yeah.
And so I mean that's I think that is a fair statement to make.
And so you would be perfectly happy if a state wanted to start doing capital punishment via public hangings?
Well, again, I don't know that I would say I would be happy about
it.
Yeah,
okay, but
would I say it is unconstitutional?
Yeah.
I don't know that I would say that.
Yeah.
No. Now, I would maybe want to push back and take something like putting someone in the stocks and say, look, you say, oh, that's cruel and unusual punishment, and how can you, you know, publicly shame someone mm-hmm. like that for making them stand, you know, for a week in the stocks or whatever.
Is it a week? Is that how long you're up in those
Well,
things?
I don't know. Whatever it was, a day, a week. I don't actually know my 19th century punishments. And I suppose a legitimate reply might be, actually, cruel and unusual punishment is locking someone away for 20 years instead of, you know, putting him in the stocks for a
while. Well, look, I mean, I'm definitely going to say that there are certain things that are a part of the modern criminal justice system that are definitely worse than being stuck in the stocks for a week.
So, but, you know, there, in a sense, there's some relativity there, which is why I think the guide is usually better. It's usually better to take the past as a minimum, right? Should you publicly hang people? Well, no, I don't actually think that we should.
But you don't think that's unconstitutional?
I don't think that's unconstitutional, but that doesn't mean that states have to do it, right? Because that's the way it's done back then. If states want to change and say, look, we're going to execute people in private with a lethal injection, I don't think that's unconstitutional either.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, the objection is that originalism is going to get the wrong answer. You're going to bite the bullet on the constitutionality of public hangings. That's not really a live issue, but certainly a more live issue is going to be something like the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, which established,
right, separate but equal.
Separate but equal. And it's certainly going to be the case that there's nothing in the Constitution at the time, there's nothing in the Constitution up to that point that would... It looks like that was a constitutionally sound decision, right?
Right. So the there is actually an originalist argument against it.
Yeah.
And, it is a good one,
uh-huh,
because we have a guide to both intent and practice.
Mm-hmm.
So what did the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments mean in the originalist sense, right? So what did they mean to that generation that passed them? We can look at what the North did as it was occupying the South during Reconstruction and say, okay, how does this look on the ground? Like, what did they intend these to mean? And what we see is that they were basically enforcing equal voting rights. They were enforcing equal access to the polls. You have African Americans who are elected as United States senators from the state of Mississippi,
mm-hmm,
in the years after the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a pretty darn good originalist guide to how things ought to be. And in that particular case, the living Constitution view would actually be the Plessy versus Ferguson. It would be yeah, I know you did that. I know that's how it was interpreted, but really this is what we want to happen.
Kind of a story that a living constitutionalist could tell, but not necessarily a story that a living constitutionalist would have to tell.
Right. And again, the other side is the originalist is going to say, look, segregation is awful. So we have our originalist argument for segregation. So, you know, Brown is defensible from an originalist position. But also, just to hammer this home, why don't we change the law? Right? Why don't we have a Civil Rights Act mm-hmm. that's passed through the Congress? Why don't we have a 25th Amendment, right, outlawing the poll tax? 25th, 24th.
Yeah.
I get those mixed up. Why don't we use the legislative process to make these changes? And won't that be better in the long run for everyone anyway? Because then you're not just imposing judicially, leading to decades of racial strife.
Yeah.
You're also having to change the culture. You're also having to change hearts and minds. You're also having to do the actual hard work of changing society rather than just sort of jumping in and trying to jump.
Yeah, straight. Yeah. So I'm sorry. I should let you.
And I was just saying, you know, as far as Brown goes, like I said, I do tend to take the originalist sort of the originalist interpretation of that and say, look at Reconstruction, and you see that there is precedent there, right? Mm-hmm. There is a legitimate way to interpret that. So I do not object to it the way some of the strict textualists do.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, because this is imposed on society rather than a sort of an organic overtime change, mm-hmm. I think some of the end result of that is we still have racial problems today. Right, there wasn't the bottom-up cultural change. There wasn't a transformation in the way we do things or the way we think about things. It was the top coming in and imposing on the bottom, and the end result was nobody was happy or has been happy for the last 60 years with the result.
So you can't possibly be saying that things would have been better off without that decision.
I can possibly be saying that things would have been better off had we come to the same result through better means.
So that's true. The question is whether those means were available in the 1950s and 1960s.
Well, I mean, as a result of Brown versus Board of Education, not one school anywhere in the country desegregated. And in fact, you have the Arkansas National Guard being called out to, mm-hmm. to keep it from happening, and then being taken over by the president and being used to implement it. And I think when you have the president sort of enforcing national policy at the point of a gun, you can pretty much say there's something seriously askew in society.
Well, I'll say this. Like, I obviously do not disagree at all. When you are able to get things done legislatively, when you are able to do the hard work of changing hearts and minds, as you say, and generating a kind of a national consensus and bringing everybody along, that's obviously awesome. What if you can't? That's kind of the issue. And I mean, the things about hearts and minds is that, I mean, hearts and minds, what you believe, what everybody believes, it's not is totally shaped by our cultural and social institutions. And so institutionalizing certain kinds of values of racial equality through the law is in fact one of the things that's going to sort of codify the fact that we believe that all people are created equally. So, I mean, you often hear people sort of tell that kind of a story, but man, if they didn't do those things, we would still be in legal segregation now.
And
one more point.
Sure.
So, Brown versus Board of Education was 1954. The Civil Rights Acts were passed in 1964. It's not as if when Brown v. Board of Education was passed, then everything was roses and it was like a big Coke commercial when people of different ethnicities were hugging. But
sure.
I mean, you can't just tell black people, "Sorry, you just got to wait." Sorry, tough luck for you. You just got to wait. Like, and that's kind of the whole point. Like, democratic values matter a lot, but we don't just live in a democracy. We live in a liberal democracy, right? And the thing that makes it liberal is that there are certain kinds of rights and liberties that are codified and are inviolable, even if the majority of people decide that we want to violate them, right? That's why we have a Bill of Rights. That's really important. if everybody in the United States decided that they want to start discriminating against Christians, for example. Like, that's not all right. But then similarly, if everybody in the United States decides that it wants to discriminate against black people, that's not all right. And it's really easy for sort of people to say, well, you know, just wait, things will be better. I mean, like, that's what it was like in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. Oh, just wait, just wait. If I'm a black person in 1950, I don't want to wait anymore. And the very changing of the court decision and the passing of laws is part of the thing that institutionalizes our commitment to certain kinds of values that in turn helps change people's hearts and minds.
Right. And you say we're a liberal democracy. I would say we are liberal in part because of the rights that we hold, but also in part because we have processes that we follow and we don't cheat with those processes.
Yeah. But
and Brown was borderline cheating.
Well, I thought you just argued that you thought that even on originalist grounds it was
Again, I think there is an originalist interpretation. I don't know. It's been so long since I've read Brown. I don't remember what argument they actually use. So as an originalist, I can support Brown. I can defend Brown. That's certainly not where it goes after that, right? I mean, that's not where that's not where Roe comes from or anything like that. So maybe I should maybe I should modify that and say.
Well, let's just. I mean, Roe is beside the point. Let's just talk about Brown.
Well, but they're still they're in that same body of sort of judicial activism, which I guess we haven't really talked about that. But anyway, the big point is we have processes and we have methods and we have ways that we do things and ways that we change things.
Yes.
And again, that's legislative. That's not judicial.
Well, look,
those kinds of changes are.
You're right. We have a system, but we don't live with just an executive and a legislative branch. We live in a country with an executive, a legislative, and a judicial branch. Like, that's a part of the system. Like, that's why the courts are there. You could design a system without a court system, and then it's just the legislature. Or even, like, you know, we live in a common law country. There are other ways of doing judicial interpretation. We could live in a civil law country, which in some ways is a little bit more deferential to legislative decisions. But we don't. So you're right, there's a system in which change takes place, but a part of that system is a court system that says, yeah, you guys can pass laws, but you're constrained by what the Constitution says, and if you pass a law that violates what the Constitution says, then that's a no-go. And then even you, as an originalist, think that there is a good and proper originalist interpretation of Brown v. Board of Education, so I don't understand why you think that's coloring outside the lines.
Well, no. Again, I do. My concern is more that sets precedence that, because in the minds of most people, it is not an originalist decision. And I guess I should ask: Do you think that segregation was, in the strict sense, unconstitutional?
Yes.
Okay. Based on what?
So, like, I think your originalist interpretation is just fine. And there are a billion living constitutional theories of judicial interpretation that are also just fine. My own view I describe as principalist. And principalism is a kind of a halfway house between originalism and living constitutionalism. And in some ways, like, I'm not wholly hostile to originalism as a theory of judicial interpretation, but I would describe myself as a principalist. And so principalism, which I guess is a theory of constitutional interpretation that is associated with the political and legal philosopher Ronald Dworkin, sees the Constitution as enumerating certain important legal and moral principles. And what matters is the principles as they would have been originally understood. So we're not reading principles into the Constitution when they're not there. We're just reading the principles, right? But then with regard to the application of those principles, we're not going to be boxed in by what they thought a person was in the 18th or 19th century, right? So they would have said that a black person isn't a person or isn't fully a person, but a principalist isn't going to be hemmed in by that. What they are going to do is to look at the broad moral principles that we find in, say, the 14th Amendment with regard to equality. And so that establishes the idea of equality under law. And people back then may or may not have understood that as applying to black persons. But if they didn't, we just know that they're wrong. But what matters is that they are articulating a principle of equality. So that's like my view, which you can kind of think of as being a halfway house. But again, like, I'm not like hostile against originalism. I think it is a tricky thing, though, in some ways. Like, Roe v. Wade is a weird decision. Going back to Connecticut v. Griswold, that's the privacy decision, right?
Yeah, Griswold, sure.
Do you think we have a right to privacy?
Constitutionally?
Yeah, you're going to say no.
Absolutely not. No, I think a Griswold is a decision that we would just never have heard of if it weren't for Roe.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that's true, because that concerned birth control, man. You said that last...
It did, but it was also... It's one of those things that it was a law that was functionally unenforceable. I mean, how do you know if a husband and wife are using birth control in the privacy of their
home? I mean, you couldn't sell birth control at stores.
Right, in Connecticut, but there were states around it.
I mean, if you lived in Hartford and you couldn't get birth control... Unless you drove over to Massachusetts or New York or, like...
Right, so that 15-minute drive to...
Well, it's not 15 minutes from Hartford, but anyways.
Connecticut's a pretty small state. Anyway,
well, I've lived in Hartford. I mean, you can get to Massachusetts in 45 minutes, but it ain't a 15-minute drive in any case. I can tell you that. So if Missouri passed a law banning birth control, that wouldn't be unconstitutional in your view.
I would not be able to pull a text out of the Constitution and say, see, this is where you're not allowed to do this.
So you might think, look, it's this is crazy. I wouldn't vote for this. If you voted for this, I'm never going to vote for you again. But you don't think it's unconstitutional.
As Scalia would say, it's stupid but constitutional. Mm-hmm. Now, there might be something in Missouri Constitution against it. That I don't know. But... As far as the U.S. Constitution goes, yeah, the idea of a right to privacy, it might be something that maybe we should amend into it, right? It might be something, although privacy is such a big word.
Yeah, and the other thing about that is that, like that's just a weird that's a weird justification for abortion, and that's a weird justification for the use of birth control. Like, you know, I would say the reason why I had the right to go out and buy birth control doesn't have to do with my right to privacy. It has to do with my... right for control over my own life. Anyways.
Yeah, and again, if that were the case, and it's one of those things that I think most, today at least, even most sort of conservative Christians, Catholics, and so on, who might have thoughts one way or the other about birth control, are rarely going to say, yeah, but we want the state to regulate it. I mean, that at least culturally, we have changed such that that's no longer the case. So, I mean...
Yeah,
but in the strict immediate result of the decision, that's why I say it's a case we probably wouldn't know about, because there are a few people out there saying, hey, birth control should be outlawed.
Well,
kinds of birth control, that's one thing, but in general, yeah. That's very different.
You know, that might not be the case right now in 2017, but it was obviously the case back in when was the Griswold case?
It was 55.
55. You know, so you lived in 55?
65. 55 or 65.
You want to exercise birth control? Like, and now you can't? You live in Connecticut? Like, that sucks for you. But, I mean, with all of that said, like, I'm not an originalist, but it's not like I'm wholly, wholly hostile to it.
Would you think it's unconstitutional?
That's a tricky... I kind of shrug my shoulders and... In a certain kind of way, it obviously isn't.
Like, based on the words and the ideas of the Constitution.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the case that if a state passed that law, it would be relatively easy to amend the Constitution. At the same time, like, there's a way in which there is a kind of a judicial value of simplicity, I think. And if we just started amending the Constitution to enshrine all of the rights that we kind of take for granted and like now, I mean, like... You know, we don't want a constitution with 100 amendments, like. And so,
which is why the process is difficult, right? I mean, that's why it's not easy to do.
But you know, I don't know. So, yeah. So, I mean, to that, I mean, it's not like I'm a scholar of jurisprudence, and I kind of do legal philosophy occasionally, but not this bit of legal philosophy. So it's not like I have a worked out professional view on this. Again, I describe my view as being principalist, and then but even then, I mean, you kind of need to do a little bit of fancy footwork, because it's sort of hard to find the relevant principle enshrined in the Constitution under which I have the freedom to make decisions about reproduction.
Right.
But on that specific issue, I just kind of shrug my shoulders, like, and maybe in some ways this kind of puts me in the living Constitution camp, because I sort of feel like that was substantively the just thing to do. Like, that's the best outcome.
And I don't even necessarily disagree with you in the case of Griswold. Like, I do not mind that birth control laws in Connecticut or across the country were overturned. Like, that's fine. I don't object to that. It's, did the court actually have the power to do mm-hmm. that constitutionally? Mm-hmm. I think the answer is pretty clearly no.
Yeah. You know, I've just sort of talked myself into a kind of a pragmatic view. Insofar as that, I kind of think justices need to weigh a whole lot of different values when they make decisions. Among those values they need to weigh are extrajudicial values of stability and predictability and order, crafting decisions that can be fairly applied going into the future. At the same time, they need, it's not usually the case that it's this way, but sometimes there are really, really weighty issues of substantive justice that need to get settled. And what matters most are justices who negotiate those competing values using practical wisdom and insight in fair ways. And I like, usually the courts get it right, I would say. You might disagree with me.
I mean, yeah, so in the absolute sense, you're right. So of the, you know, 70 to 80 cases a year the Supreme Court hears, 70 of them, right, 75 of them are going to be either unanimously decided or pretty closely to unanimously decided and totally unobjectionable. But it's that five or six cases they hear a year that make the national news, that people pay attention mm-hmm. to. That's where I think sometimes they're right and sometimes they're wrong. There was a stretch of time, I think, when they were mostly wrong through the era of the Warren Court, where mostly they were just sort of reading their preferred social policy positions into the law and into the Constitution.
Can I ask you a question? Sorry, where are we going at this point? Are we more or less sort of done with all the really substantive stuff?
I think so. I was going to say something about my interpretation of it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah, we should certainly do... Well, yeah, so you do your bit, and then I want to ask you a question about Citizens United.
Okay. Yeah, we should do an episode just on that. Yeah, so basically where I fall judicially, I am largely an originalist, but I would want to say that the Constitution is, rather than being so much focused on sort of rights and principles, the proper way to look at the Constitution is as a document that either restrains or enables the use of power. So most of what the Constitution is doing, with the exception basically of the preamble, is saying government, whether the president or the Congress or the Supreme Court or the states, can do or cannot do X, Y, or Z things. So really what we're talking about when we're talking about these difficult issues of judicial interpretation is, do you think the government can do whatever it is that's in question? And in that case, the Constitution, by and large, is a good guide. I mean, there are things Congress is allowed to do and there are things Congress is not allowed to do. And when that's in question, so Congress has the power to regulate commerce, right? So what isn't commerce? Everything we do has some kind of financial something attached to it. When how far the government can go or whether or not the government should be going farther is in question, that's when sort of my originalism kicks in, right? That's when I'm going to say, well, by and large, we need to go with what the people who wrote it intended it to be, what they meant it to be, and And yeah, well, let the past guide us. I don't know that I have much beyond that.
Can you give a particular example of a decision or a legislative action that you sort of violates the Commerce Clause?
Oh, the Commerce Clause? No, I picked that as an example. That's usually what the court uses to. It's been a while since I've looked at some of my con law stuff. But Commerce Clause is usually what the court uses to uphold things like the Civil Rights Act, based on commerce power, because we trade with each other, so that's interstate commerce. So trading with states with Jim Crow laws, you know, enables Congress to step in there. Although, again, don't hold me specifically to that. Yeah, getting more detailed than that, I don't know that I would be able to off the top of my head.
Really? The commerce laws? With regard to civil rights decisions? Which civil rights decisions specifically?
Oh, man. There was one that was like a barbecue. So Katzenbach versus McClung. So in the 60s, the Supreme Court basically said that Congress, made a racial discrimination in restaurants illegal, the Supreme Court used the Commerce Clause as the power. Basically, there's a barbecue, Ollie's Barbecue, in Birmingham, Alabama, that was, you know, near to an interstate highway, and they bought food from out of state, and people from out of state would come and eat there, and the Supreme Court sort of used that as the way of saying, hey, Congress was right when it passed the Civil Rights Act, or that section of the Civil Rights Act. And it's been a while since I've read these cases, so I don't
know.
Well, I mean,
why not just appeal to equal protection under the law?
Yeah, because that's such a vague statement that...
I don't see how that's vague. It's saying that, like, you can't make arbitrary distinctions between people and say that some people have these rights and responsibilities and powers and other people don't.
Yeah, except that that's sort of something we do a lot, and...
Yeah, so the important bit there is arbitrary.
Right, right. I mean, up until very recently, we would have said something like, look, we discriminate between men and women in terms of which bathroom you have to use. I used to say that's not controversial, but it is still a distinction that we make, so you can't just say absolutely.
I would say that the current controversy is not controverting the distinction between men and women's bathrooms. I would say that it has to do with what a man or a woman is, but anyways. Let's really not talk about that.
Right.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So, you know, among the hardest of hard cases is the Citizens United decision, which struck down the campaign finance laws. Can mm-hmm. you sort of talk about that from an originalist perspective?
Yeah. So there's sort of a pattern in campaign finance laws. We'll have an election where lots of money will be spent. You know, in the election of Barack Obama, I think he still has the record of, you know, something like $1 billion to get himself elected president. There will be a reaction to that in Congress that rightly says, isn't it terrible that all of this money was spent on campaigns? And so they will crack down on campaign spending. Some kind of law will be put in place starting back in the 70s. This is by no means a new thing. Mm-hmm. The first thing that will happen is people find ways around it. So these laws never actually accomplish anything. And they usually just lead to more spending because now you found a way around it and there are no regulations on the way around it, whatever that way around it happens to be. The spending increases because whatever laws were in place before this can now be ignored. And then a lawsuit will be filed saying, hey, this is a violation of free speech. It'll go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court so far has very, very consistently said, yes, this is in fact a violation of free speech.
Campaigns, campaign contributions are a violation of free speech.
Restricting campaign contributions
is
a violation.
Yes, right.
And again, it's not just the originalists on the court who say that, but I think they sort of have the strongest argument of, you know, look, we have a First Amendment. It is explicitly to protect political speech, right? There are forms of speech that are not protected by the First Amendment, but political speech absolutely is protected by it. They knew about campaigning and money being spent on campaigns mm-hmm. when they wrote the amendment, and nothing was said about you have the right to free speech unless you're giving money to a politician for his campaign.
Uh-huh.
So that's sort of the originalist view. I assume the non-originalist view is very similar in that free speech matters even today. A modern contemporary value is your right to support the candidate that you would like to see get into office. So you and I, if we decide that we really, really dislike Donald Trump in the 2020 election, if we want to go on TV and pay for an ad to run where you and I just go on TV and explain exactly how much we dislike mm-hmm. him, That's clearly protected free speech, mm-hmm. right? That's clearly the definition of what's supposed to be going on there. Now, if there's 200 of us who get together and do that, if there's 2,000 of us who get together and do that, or 2 million of us, all of a sudden, in the minds of some people, that becomes not okay. There's sort of a tipping point where now it's too much. So I don't think anyone disagrees that too much money is spent on elections. I think that's sort of universally agreed upon. The problem is, so far, there is no way to restrict that without also restricting
free
speech.
That thing that you just said isn't true. There are lots of people who have no problem with the amount of money that's being spent in elections.
No one who's really willing to say so publicly.
I totally disagree. There was a conservative congressman who said something about, if anything, the problem is that there isn't more money being spent. I mean, find me a conservative who says, he just says what a conservative politician who says what you just said.
Yeah, again, are you gonna find a conservative politician who says it's a social good that we're spending $1 billion on a presidential election?
And David Koch think that.
They didn't spend it on the presidential election.
Well, yeah, but that's because they didn't like the president, nominee from your party. Sheldon Adelson doesn't think that.
Well, that's fair. So, I mean, obviously,
So I'll just say this.
George Soros, right, doesn't think
that.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's wrong, actually. I think Soros does think that. I think his view is that...
yet he spends the money.
No. That's absolutely right. But I think he thinks that in the current environment, it would be crazy not to do it. But he would prefer an environment in which nobody spends that amount of money. But given what the ground rules are... Whereas I think Charles Koch, it's not that they think, well, we're just spending it because that's how the game is played now, but gosh, we wish it weren't. No, like they like how it is now.
But, yeah, I don't know about that. I can't imagine that they like spending $700 million of their dollars on campaigns.
I think they love it. I mean, they don't like the spending of the money, but they like the ability to influence elections. They love that.
Oh, well, that may be true, but that's true of me when I spend a dollar to, anyone. I mean, so again, the use of your money in support of your political opinions, yes, that is a positive good. That part I don't disagree with.
But you were just suggesting that there ought to be limits to the extent to which anybody can do that. There's too much money in politics.
No. I'm saying there is too much money in politics. Yes, I'm not saying there should be legal limits on it. That's not what I'm saying.
Okay. Well, in any case, two questions. I mean, there's kind of a stronger and weaker version of it. Like, you were making this point about how when you look at the First Amendment, like, they could have said more about how it doesn't apply to campaign spending, but they didn't. Like, an originalist can't say that. Like, you can't look at and say, well, they could have said this, and they didn't say this, so therefore we're going to interpret that omission in a particular kind of a way. Like,
or amend the Constitution.
Yeah, but my point is, like, you can't go looking to what they don't say as interpretation of what they do say.
You can if they're the sorts of issues that are like actual, so like something like the death penalty, right? Is the death penalty unconstitutional? Well, there was a very brief time when the Supreme Court had said it is, but it's not explicitly in the Constitution. So I think you're within your rights to say, look, they had the chance to write this in and say you have the right not to be executed, and
yeah,
they didn't do it.
Okay.
So either we need to add an amendment, or we don't get to say, hey, this is unconstitutional.
And so I guess I would say the slight difference there is that the Constitution does directly address the question of punishment. So it's sort of directly. Now let's talk about...
And the Constitution directly addresses the question of elections and of speech.
So then I would say the First Amendment doesn't directly address the question of elections. I mean...
No, but Article 1 does.
Yeah, but...
I mean, it's in the Constitution.
Yeah, but if we're talking about First Amendment jurisprudence, we just got to look at the... Right? And so free speech is one thing. So if somebody wants to sort of go out and... This is one of those instances in which I think originalist interpretations are disingenuous. So we're originalists. We're interested in what the publicly acceptable meanings of the word are at the time at which they were written. What does the word speech mean? Speech means speech. Now, maybe it wouldn't be a violation of those principles of constitutional interpretation to also say that speech isn't just speech, but it's campaign.
So it's your right to print up your speech and distribute it. It's your...
That's fine. But
which, again, is going to involve money, right?
It's going to involve money, but the separate issue of being able to give money to campaign, like the idea that money itself is speech, is crazy.
Oh, yeah, I understand why you say that, but when it comes to campaigns and elections, it is. I mean,
it isn't. I mean, speech means speech. It doesn't mean money. In the late 18th century, if you use the English word speech, nobody would assume you to be talking about money in any way, shape, or form. You know,
but they might assume you to include. They might assume that you include. You know, again, having your own book published, right? Paying to have your book published.
Yeah. So that again, I mean, so that I think is a separate thing. But it's the idea that there can't be limits on what you give a politician. Like campaign contributions are not speech.
You're going sort of the wrong direction. There is an originalist argument against campaign spending. It's to say, look. The Constitution says Congress shall not make these laws. If states want to put campaign limits in place, power to them, right? If states want to restrict free speech, awesome, they can go and do it. Now, one of the things that's happened in sort of the century and a half since the Civil War is we've started applying these First Amendment principles to the states. And again, that's where I think you start getting into judicial overreach and so on. But because the court has said, these principles apply sort of across the board, well, then it has. But I think there is an originalist case to be made there. And the objection to and Citizens United is not dealing with the state case, right? It is dealing with McCain-Feingold and the video that was made about Hillary Clinton and so on. So, I mean, it is a national case that we're dealing with. But if you want to make the case that states should be allowed to, you know, implement campaign finance things, I won't necessarily disagree with you. Depending on what that state has in its own constitution.
So, two things there. First of all, again, like, it's not about... You keep on bringing it back to speech. My fundamental point is that campaign spending isn't speech. A book is speech. That's fine. Even a political ad, I suppose, is speech. But campaign contribution is not speech.
Well, Ed, what do they do with the campaign contributions? But they make political ads. They print up materials. It's not like they're putting it in their pockets. I mean, you are contributing to the election of that person by means of...
But that's not what the First Amendment... I mean, the First Amendment says you have the right to free speech. You have the right to say stuff. It doesn't say that you have the right to give unlimited amounts of money to a politician.
Someone else to say stuff for me?
That's different.
It's exactly the same thing.
It's not the same thing.
I'm paying their campaign to go out and create advertisements and... Do all of the stuff that you do when you're campaigning. Again, this campaign finance contributions, you're not bribing voters, you're not putting money in politicians' pockets. You're paying for the campaign. You're paying for the speech that happens along the way. What is the money being used for if not for speech?
It's being used for lots of things. I mean, it could be used for anything. It could be used for
signs that are put up in yards.
Get out the vote efforts.
Again, how is that not speech?
Well, get out the vote effort is not speech.
When someone comes to your house and says, hey, we would like you to come and vote, we will...
That's not speech. I mean, speech is what you and I are doing now, right?
It is at least this.
Though some people might disagree, actually.
The quality of speech is not in question, but...
But the First Amendment protects an individual right to speak, right? To enunciate their views. That's what speech is. What it doesn't say is people have free speech, and people also have the right to pay other people to speak for them. Like, that's not speech.
But is not, and I guess here we're getting into the penumbras and emanations, right? doesn't it not also imply that you get to choose how you exercise your speech?
Yeah, and so you can talk, you can stand on a soapbox, you can talk in the town square. You can go on.
So again, could you and I go on TV and run a campaign ad against Donald Trump in 2020? Is that something you and I could do?
Would that be a fair exercise of free speech? Then I suppose that would be fine. Yes, that's speech.
Okay. At what point does that become illegal?
When you give that money to somebody else
to do exactly the same thing. So if someone pays us to do that, now it's illegal. If we do it out of our own pockets and on our own time, it's fine. Someone else gives us money to go out and do that because they think it'll be more effective than if they do it themselves. That's illegal.
That's purchasing a kind of an influence over the political process that I think is nefarious. And Congress agreed, and so they passed the law. And then the Supreme Court stepped in with a crazy justification of saying that money is speech. I mean, like, money is not speech.
Based on those principles that you were lauding.
The principles are all on my side. So for one thing, you can't talk about principles. But then I would...
Right. So I will say the traditional interpretation is on my side in this case. So.
Only if you think speech is money. Only if you think that you could go back to 18th century America and pay for a pound of sugar by talking to the person.
I think if you go back to 19th century America, 18th century America. And say, you know what? And say, you know, Congress is going to forbid you from supporting someone's campaign for whatever. Like, whatever it is that they're running for.
Yeah.
They're going to think you're a crazy person. Like, again, there might be city ordinances, there might be state ordinances. I don't know state and local laws back then. But, yeah. And I suppose I don't know federal law either. So if we have, you know, some historian of you know, the 19th and 18th centuries who knows of ancient congressional acts, that's fine. My understanding is the first time this really happens is in the 70s. I suppose I might be wrong. But
I bet you anything that's not right, and I totally disagree with the premise that people are going to find that crazy. And so they say, look, there's going to be this point in time in which people are literally spending billions of dollars on political elections. Like, you think George Washington would be like, yeah, that's awesome. You know, I think it's great when commercial powers are involved in political processes like that.
And hey, I do not disagree with the sentiment, but can you restrict that without restricting someone's right to free speech?
Yes.
I don't think you can, so I think it requires an amendment to fix that. So if you want campaign finance reform, fine, it needs to be an amendment.
So I totally agree with you, but then I would also
Or a state law.
But then I would also say, and I want to come back to that point, you can't possibly mean that, but they passed a law. Like, the amendment is what's left. But it shouldn't have had to come. They passed a law. They said, look, this is a problem. We're going to pass a law. You know, the democratically elected – see, this is the way in which, like, earlier you were all about democratic processes. And I was sort of arguing for, like, the centrality of rights. And you were poo-pooing rights. And now the shoe is on the other foot.
Yeah, I mean, there's – I suppose there's something to that other than this isn't a sort of undefined right like privacy that's not really there. This is freedom of speech that is clearly in the First Amendment.
And then
one of those things where we have said, Congress, you cannot do this thing.
Yeah.
Like, it's not even, like, vague or unclear. It's Congress, you're not allowed to do this. Again, maybe state governments can, maybe local governments can. Congress doesn't get to.
The core example that
Congress
I was using...
did, so the court steps in and says, hey, you've gone too far.
Yeah. So the core example that I was using earlier didn't have to do with privacy. It had to do with equality, which is in there. Equality under law is in there. That's not vague. When we're talking about civil rights laws, in which you were suggesting that the world might have been a better place if Board v. Education had gone the other way. But then the simple point, like, is that, but money isn't speech. Money isn't speech. Nobody in the 18th century thought that money was speech.
And I don't know that I would agree with that, but I don't know enough about the 18th century to be able to answer that.
If you can find an 18th century English dictionary in which money figures in any way, shape, or form in the definition, the English language plain definition of the word speech, then.
But do they see the way you use your resources as an expression of speech in the 18th century? I would imagine they do.
So a couple things. I don't imagine that they would do, that they do. And that doesn't really sound like originalism. Originalism is, let's just look at the text. What is the plain English meaning of the text? What is the word speech? That's originalist jurisprudence.
And again, I would want you to sort of draw the line at which point the way I'm using my money in a campaign is somehow not free speech, right? So again, using our example of going on TV,
that's supporting a, I mean, supporting a candidate is not speech.
Supporting a candidate is speech.
Giving money to a candidate is not a speech act. I mean, giving money to a candidate is not a speech act. Actually, technically speaking, depend upon your theory of philosophy of language, maybe that is a speech act, actually.
Well, yeah.
But not for the purposes
without going
of,
all weird and postmodern, I would say it's totally a speech act. It is. In some ways, it's the only thing some people can do. And that's not the people who are giving $700 million, but I mean the people who have full-time jobs and so on.
They can go out on this corner and say, vote for Donald Trump, and they can cast a ballot. That's a lot. But
they can give money to a campaign that will have someone who does that.
On giving unlimited sums, that's a different deal. Right, the right to free speech isn't the right for me to exercise speech. It's not the right for me to pay someone else to talk for me.
I disagree.
Well, anyways,
let me also
get to this other point. So you're trying to suggest that like the amendments don't apply to states, and that they don't.
So this is the doctrine of incorporation again is the idea that post Civil War the court starts sort of slowly applying not all of the first 10 amendments apply have been incorporated. There are some of the grand jury stuff. I don't know all of the criminal rights there, but many of them have been where the court goes back and reads into the Bill of Rights that this also restrains states.
And is that the view that you're advocating, or are you not advocating that view? So the federal government can't pass a law that violates any of the rights enshrined in the Bill of Rights, but the state of Missouri could.
Right. Assuming it's not, you know, also enshrined in our own
constitution. But are you advocating that view, or are you not advocating that view?
Advocating which view?
The view that the state of Missouri could pass a law that violates something that's clearly enshrined in the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, I'd be fine with that, assuming that the last 100 years of Supreme Court jurisprudence hadn't happened.
There's that whole other thing, and the idea that in the common there's stare decisis and in a common law
right.
system.
So because of the disruption it would include, I would say no, that would be. Even though I think the process would be more legitimate, it would be too disruptive of the system. But the big example is church and state, right? So there was an official state church of Massachusetts into like the 1830s. Mm-hmm. I mean, it lasted for a while. Same thing in the state of Virginia. I don't think there was anything unconstitutional about that whatsoever. I think it was a bad idea. As a Baptist, I am radically opposed to that sort of thing. But that's not the same thing as saying it was unconstitutional.
So similarly, if the state of Missouri decided that it wanted to restrict people's religious liberties, you wouldn't have a problem with that.
Again, I would say that is terrible, terrible policy. And again, it's a violation of 100 years of jurisprudence. It's a violation of our own state constitution. But in the strict interpretation of the First Amendment, it's Congress that shall make no law, not the states, not the local governments. So I have no particular objection with the local ordinances that many communities have that forbid the sale of pornography, right? That is an explicit restriction on free speech, but it's not an unconstitutional one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the pornography issue is, I mean, so one thing about free about like rights, I mean, it's not like they're unlimited, right? So you.
Sure.
I can't.
So there are things like fighting words. I mean, and encouraging people to do illegal things.
Yeah. So I mean,
we're not even talking about those. I mean, we're just talking about
good old
sort of basic things that any libertarian would be, you know, fine with something like pornography. I don't mind the local government having an ordinance in place that makes that illegal. I think that's within their legal rights and, you know, a fine enough thing to do.
Because pornography is speech.
Yeah, I mean it's. The press, I guess. Maybe I should say freedom of the press instead of speech. Either way, I mean, I don't know that...
Yeah, so Hustler's the press? Well, anyways, I mean, I don't...
I'm no expert in how magazines are printed, but I would assume so.
Yeah, well, let's not talk about that.
Oh, come on, Ed. Let's have your defense of Hustler magazine.
No, you're the one defending Hustler. But, yeah...
No, I'm the one saying it's fine, they're banned. I'm the one saying outlaw the
sale. Yeah, but that's operating on the assumption that it's actually protected under the First Amendment or whatever.
Yeah. So again, if Congress wants to do that, that's when I say, wait a second, that's not okay.
To me, it's not entirely clear that it's protected by the First Amendment. But if a state wanted to start oppressing a group of people, Christians or Muslims or Black people, if they passed Sharia law saying that women couldn't go out with their heads uncovered. That's not unconstitutional in your view.
And that's where, again, that's where, like you were pointing out, the 14th Amendment is, in some ways, it's unfortunate that it wasn't written more clearly. Right. A lot of our difficulties politically would be straightened up if the 14th Amendment were clearer in its language.
Equal protection under law.
Right. And due process shall not be denied. Again, specifically, what does that mean? How do we interpret that? And so on. So within those boundaries. So if a state, you know, outlaws a certain kind of speech, but exempts the majority of the population from it, then you say, well, look, 14th Amendment has been
violated. So one interesting thing about the 14th Amendment. So the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, etc.
Right.
But the 14th Amendment says no state shall make no state.
Right.
So I suppose that the 14th Amendment, its applicability to states is, there's no question about that.
Yep. So, yeah, so 13, 14, and 15 are the Civil War amendments that restrain the power of the states and empower Congress. So there, you also have the last clause in each of them that says Congress shall have the power to enforce this law by, you know, by statute or whatever exactly it says.
But on your view, if a state deprived people of free exercise of religion or freedom of speech or the press or the right of people to peaceably assemble or the right for people to petition the government for a redress of grievances, that's okay with you?
I would say it's immoral. It would have to be so carefully done as not to violate that equal protection clause of the 14th Amendment. You would have to make sure that you are genuinely depriving everyone of the same right.
We all?
Yeah, but yeah, I would say that is stupid but constitutional. Again, to quote Scalia.
All right.
Yeah.
That seems crazy to me, but anyways.
The perils of not being able to read my own value system into the document. Right? If I were a non-originalist, this would be so much easier. I could just say, no, of course you can't do that, because I don't feel that you should. And, yeah.
That's a pejorative way of putting the point. It's not just that I feel, right? I mean,
because culture as a whole.
No, because
right now,
because we have a moral right to certain kinds of things. I mean, as it is, I mean, you feel that we should interpret the document a particular kind of a way. Right? We all have views, but if that's the whole story, then you would just be a postmodern skeptic, right? Of course we all have views. But the question is that what are the views anchored in? And so then I'd want to say, look, people have rights. They have these rights because we were all created in the image of God and have an intrinsic kind of dignity that deserves respect. And that respect is violated when those rights are infringed.
Right. And I would say I believe that we should all have the right to, you know, sort of worship in whatever church we want to on Sunday morning or gather as an assembly of believers. But then I also have to ask the question, does the Constitution enable the state that I live in to violate that right, or at least not prevent it from doing so? And I think the answer is pretty clearly no. Now, again, the court has sort of read it as if it is, and we have a state constitution that provides certain protections. But if we're reading this strictly as you know, sort of as the text is written, well, it's just not there.
But speech is money.
But speech is
or money.
Money
is speech, I should say.
But Congress restricting my freedom of speech is there.
Okay. Well, do you have anything else?
I do not have anything else, and this is going to be a long episode. I'm sorry that you have to edit so much.
No, here. That's all right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you for listening to a stimulating discussion of constitutionalism with Coyle Neal and myself. Again, please do shoot us your questions for our Ask Me Anything episode forthcoming. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast or shoot us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. We are very proud members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik, who at this very moment is very busy getting both John Edwards on the phone for an upcoming episode. Please do give us a rating on iTunes if you are able. Leave us a review there. That's the best way to help people find the show. Equally, like our Facebook page at the aforementioned URL. Otherwise, let me close by reminding everybody, as always, to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's. Thanks so much for
listening. This land is your land, and this land is my land. And the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.